This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
So I'm going to launch straight into the paper in the interest of time. I know the 20 minutes hangs over me. And so the paper is necessarily redacted, but I am very happy to speak further during discussion and also to answer any questions. I want to start with a description of smoke on the Tibetan plateau, an imagined account, as it were, to follow one trajectory of smoke from when it emerges to how it wafts and what it does before eventually dispersing, vanishing into air. I'll build from these initial observations to multiple interpretations of what smoke is, and in the process, draw some preliminary, and I mark here preliminary insights, on the delineation between the mental and the material that I hope will contribute to our discussions on material rethinking. This is section one, yeah, of this workshop. Now, nomadic pastoralists of the Tibetan Plateau generally live at altitudes above 3,700 meters and rely primarily on dried yak dung for fuel. In black tents like this, the yak dung hearth occupies a central position and is used not only to boil water for tea, oftentimes five times a day, but also to heat milk that is converted to butter, to hard and soft cheeses, and as well yogurt in the summer. This almost constant burning of yak dung releases smoke, both into the black tent itself, as you can see, there are no chimneys, but also to the general environment. One early 20th century account, a census method, was to count the plumes of smoke on the vast grasslands to indicate the number of households in a given area. So ubiquitous and important is the yak dung hearth to life on the plateau. Yak dung smoke wafts out of the top flaps of the black tent in thick billows, especially when nomad women attend to their daily chores. Sometimes, if the woman is not paying attention, the boiling milk overflows from the pot onto hot hearthstones, causing additional smoke and vapor. At this point, however, the woman will usually take dried juniper leaves and put them onto the hot hearthstone, chanting a quick Om Mani Padme Hum. Because this burnt milk is an affront. It's a pollution to the tabla, or the hearth god. This is one of the many worldly, or shall we say, immanent deities that live on the plateau, often in mountains, but also underground and in lakes as water spirits called le. To appease the tabla, the woman will sprinkle the leaves. The smell of incense pleases the god, and its fragrant smoke inevitably combines with the smoke of the yak dung in the tent. This scant sprinkling of incense is one mild version of ritual, however. Another burns layer upon layer of dried juniper branches and is accompanied by specific chants from ritual practitioners invoking the fortune and power of specific territorial deities called Jibdak or Yulla. Sometimes bowls of butter mixed with tea and tsampa, this is the ground roasted barley flour that's a Tibetan staple, are also burned. The juniper and tsampa produce dense and fragrant smoke for the fumigation or purification rituals called sang. Importantly, sang not only confers good fortune, but also purifies the gods themselves. John Belezza has written about how the gods have a limpid composition, sangrik, and these means that they are prone to pollution from negative anthropogenic activities. Sang and its smoke purifies the gods, indicating a critical mutuality between human and non-human. The dense and fragrant smoke permeates human nostrils as well. Apart from smell, incense smoke has a gentle quality when it enters one's nasal passages, sometimes something not shared by the acrid smoke of yak dung. Yet, as pastoralists will also say, smoke from dried yak dung is not as hot, it's not as tsa, as, say, smoke from wood, and it doesn't hurt one's eyes. So as with all smoke, though, these concentrated plumes dissipate into wispy tendrils that eventually, seemingly, melt into air. I now start the section of my paper that unpacks and analyzes the brief description just presented. I had said that smoke dissipates into the air. Scientists, however, focus on a different reality. For them, smoke is composed of vapor, gases, and particulates, various fine particles that enter our respiratory system as well as the climate system of the planet. Specifically, ultrafine particulate matter, PM2.5 or PM10, depending on the nanometer, has been identified by the WHO as a direct cause of lung damage, leading to illnesses from asthma to cancer. Another kind of particulate matter, black carbon, BC, eventually settles back onto the ground. At high altitude and in the vicinity of many of the world's glaciers, BC, from incomplete and inefficient combustion of yak dung, settles on ice and transforms the glaciers from heat reflectors to heat retainers. Trapping heat in a high altitude basin causes permafrost to melt, and this affects those living on the plateau as well as downstream. So, there's this growing scientific literature on climate change in the Third Pole that really identifies Tibetan pastoralists, because of where they live and their burning practices, as somehow disproportionately influencing the rate of melting permafrost and therefore more responsible than others for global climate change, right? So I think one can see quite easily how such data can, not always, but can be used to justify policies to relocate pastoralists, not only for their own health, but also for the health of the planet. But to return to our concerns here, I mentioned these scientific narratives on human and planetary health because of the assumptions that underlie them. Despite the seemingly immaterial, amorphous form of smoke, for scientists, smoke is material. Not only because of its composition as particulate matter, but also because of the physical effects it causes within the human body and on the permafrost. As substance, although varying in degree and composition, no doubt, all smoke is the same. Engaging with the Tibetan perspective, though, we might focus on smoke to build up a slightly different analysis. And here, again, because of time, I cannot fully dwell on the issue. Suffice to say that Tibetans note a difference between smoke in general, which is called dua, and what results from the smoke purification ritual, tsang. Generally, Tibetan pastoralists are ambivalent about dua, despite scientific warnings. But tsang, on the other hand, is not a matter of ambivalence. Here, smoke must be taken along with the incense, the ritual chants, the practitioner, the community, and the deities to be regarded as the entire ritual complex of tsang. And to contextualize what I'll next say, it is ritual in its own right, to invoke Handelman's very fine edited volume. So tsang is usually performed for multiple, often overlapping reasons. One, a petition to avoid displeasure or anger of the deity for a specific pollution, drip. The granting of special powers or fortunes for a particular event, such as a horse race. So you have sort of these little multiple tsang being performed before summer horse races, these big events. Three, it can be an application for continued good fortune or wealth, the nor, or animals of a household. Or four, a conferral of good health and well-being to members of a household. Importantly, these are not, as I've mentioned before, these are not petitions to the transcendent, often embodied deities of the Buddhist pantheon, but to immanent beings that live in the world, interact with other living beings, feel anger, jealousy, approval, and pleasure. They enact deeds with positive or negative effects in daily life. Burning liquids, digging earth, moving stones are just a few of the many transgressive acts that cast a pollution in the world and that affect these deities with their limpid composition. I want to dwell in the time remaining on a specific ethnographic example that I hope elaborates the effect of anthropogenic activities on worldly deities and the significance of tsang in creating and restoring human non-human relationships. And I hope I'll have some time to also perhaps elaborate on some of those issues. In the historical experience of one particular pastoral community of eastern Tibet, as with others on the plateau, the People's Liberation Army camped in this place in the 1950s. While there, the soldiers of the PLA destroyed local stupas, cut down forests, and killed wildlife. At that time, as it was recounted to me, the worldly deity, or the Jigdenpa Ila, of the place left. It fled. It went away. And it also went away and was not able to come back because its ritual practitioner was taken away as well. In the ensuing years, as it was recounted, the place, as with others on the plateau, was a site of various societal upheavals, from the Great Leap Forward and the ensuing famine to the Cultural Revolution, and then to the social policies of collectivism, corporatism, and the individual household responsibility system. All these are policies implemented by the Chinese government. Presently, the particular area has seen massive and rapid developments. Roads have brought increased traffic to the area. Government money has partially paid for new houses and the resettlement of new model villages. And other associated activities and businesses have flourished. So this is a place of remarkable change, right? Rapid change. The local incarnate lama, concerned about these latest developments and their impacts on the fortune of the place, and in particular on the purity of the water streaming from the lakes and glaciers, wanted to call back a worldly deity so that it would fortify the place and bring good fortune to its people. Yet the original worldly deity could not be called back because its own ritual practitioner was no longer around. The deity had gone away. But the lama then strategized to call another, more powerful worldly deity called Jara Jigden to this place by inviting its ritual practitioner to perform a ritual and to move to this new place. It's like setting up a new home, another home, right? Not to move away from its current residence in the mountain, but to set up another abode. And so this ritual was a sang that was performed, and it was based on a particular sang yik, or ritual chant, of approximately 10 pages. And I'm just going to briefly read through some of it. It begins, this is the complete action for the collection of activities of smoke offerings to the most secret territorial master, Zara Latse. It begins with a homage to the Guru Padma and notes how this most revered host tamed the snow land of Tibet. It describes Jara Jubdak as Yarla Shampo's younger brother and details the offerings and gifts that are to be presented to him. It portrays Jara Jubdak as holding aloft a victory banner and a water jug, riding a white yak. It describes him as the protector, riding a white horse with a cape and a lance banner, defeating the various demons of the region. It reiterates the purpose of the smoke offering to soothe and to purify not only Jara, but also the myriad water spirits, sky spirits, and demons of the region, and so on. And so here I want to come back to the ritual of sang. And sort of think about it a little bit and think about what we might be able to think through and with about sang. The example given reinforces Beletsa's point that the sang ritual invoked by spirit mediums is composed of two parts, the actual fumigation of the deity and the supplications to them. In this case, the supplication was to persuade Jara Jigden to move into another abode. But to tie back to the concerns of this symposium and understand how smoke both maintains and recreates relations in a Tibetan pastoralist's life world, I want to consider sang as purification, but on two levels. First, in its everyday context, the woman, Omanipemoom, on the hot hearthstones. That sang purifies the pollution from an activity, a transgressive act. But in a second level, in another kind of purification, in the context, in the ritual context of spirit mediums, sang purifies the deity itself. So let's kind of take a moment to consider what the implications are. On the first level, to purify the pollution from a certain activity, several assumptions, I think, are at play. But these do not necessarily shift our thinking of how we perceive about humans or deities and smoke, or even about mental and material boundaries and distinctions. So, in the first level, an activity is performed that causes a pollution. The worldly deities are displeased by the pollution, and therefore a counteraction, the sang, is undertaken to both remove the pollution and to please the deity itself. All of this to avoid further negative consequence, right? This counteraction can be understood as a relationship established by the smoke purification ritual. But in this situation, I think our understanding of the world hasn't really shifted. Humans, deities, activities exist in a triangle of action and interaction that assumes that the humans and the deities are a priori distinct, already there, connected through the cause and effect of action and interaction. But let us analytically examine the second level, namely to purify the worldly deity itself. A smoke purification ritual is performed for the deity. A mitigating activity or pollution might or might not motivate the ritual, but the focus on the ritual is the deity itself. An important observation here is that the worldly deity needs people as much as people need them. They are themselves as immanent deities given full expression through their crucial relationships with humans. And here we might understand sang as an expression of virtuality, or that space proposed by Kapfra as the really real, right? Ritual not as representation of the world or somehow interpreted according to everyday concepts of sociality and power, but ritual as that space of the really real, in sort of an instantiation of internal vitality. Here, the assumptions of the previous instance do not necessarily hold. We cannot assume that the worldly deity and people, humans, are a priori in existence before the relationship that is established by the smoke purification ritual. Rather, the ethnographic detail is consistent with the conclusion that deity and people come to be in mutual interdependence during the smoke purification ritual. Sang, through smoke, through ritual chants, the practitioner, its participants, creates the relationships that allow deities to continue being deities and humans to continue being supplicants. An additional point to note here is that these are not either-or propositions. Sang is both a purification from, that is, an activity that expresses relationships among already existing entities, and a purification of, something, a ritual that creates and recreates relationships and the coming into existence of beings, right? So I think this is a really critical point for me, that we're not talking about mutual exclusivity, that it's either this or that, but that it can be both, and that Tibetan pastoralists in their daily interactions in their life worlds are able to accommodate both. It's the both and. Smoke in Tibet then signals not just a material substance as defined from a scientific point of view, but as part of a ritual complex. As part of sang, it is more than something that connects various entities. Moreover, as part of sang, smoke is a transformation that expresses an internal vitality, both of human and non-human. Sang purifies, and when understood to purify the deities themselves, emphasizes, I think, not a substantialist ontology of being, but rather a mutually constituting, shall we say, virtuality or becoming. Now, to conclude, this paper has attempted to draw out multiple perspectives on and analyses of smoke in order to understand the kind and intensity of differences around this idea of smoke. It has regarded smoke in Tibet as an appropriate heuristic device to highlight questions of perhaps a mental-material dualism. As substance dualism, exemplified through scientific thinking about smoke, the mental and the material are incommensurable. And here I think it's analytically important to note that conceptual dualism necessitates this incommensurability, right? It's not just binary opposition, which can be the hot and cold of temperature, for example, or the both sides of the coin. I mean, that is monism, the one substance with the two aspects. But a sort of substance dualism that maintains an incommensurability of terms. They're radically different in that extent, to that extent. Maintaining this point of view of incommensurability, smoke is a material substance that cannot then also be viewed as enervating or being internal vitality. These qualities are only appropriate to the mental. However, through the ethnography, and I hope through the analyses presented, smoke in Tibet is more than that. As sang, it purifies and transforms, allowing us to begin to understand not mutual exclusivity, but a particular type of incommensurability, the working out of a both-and, which signals to me a kind of non-dualism. Non-dualism is the paradox that recognizes radically different terms, yet allows them to not be incommensurable. Right? And I think I might just finish there. Thank you.